Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did we all become so addicted to our devices and the apps they run? A survey last year found a third of Americans admitted they would give up sex before parting with their cell phones. And nearly 4 in 5 of us check those phones within 15 minutes of waking up in the morning. In addition to their undeniable utility, the computers and apps in our lives have come to seem indispensable because of the way they act on our brains, setting up a self-reinforcing loop of engagement, activity, reward, and investment that many companies are now deliberately trying to work into the new products they design. Nir Eyal is a veteran of the video gaming and advertising industry and has taught courses on applied consumer psychology at Stanford Graduate School of Business and the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design. His new book, written with Ryan Hoover, is called Hooked: How to Build Habit-Forming Products. Nir, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
When you talk about being hooked on a product, what do you mean exactly?
Well, so these products that we find ourselves drawn to in our day-to-day lives, these products that have kind of come out of nowhere, if you think about it, these companies that many of us dismiss as toys or these nice-to-have products that in the span of the past 5 to 10 years have had a profound impact on our day-to-day lives. And of course, I'm talking about these companies like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Pinterest and WhatsApp that have somehow, you know, captured billions of dollars in economic value and have hooked some of these companies, billions of people. Take a look at Facebook, touching 1 in every 8 people on the face of the earth. And these people are checking these products habitually. They're checking them with little or no conscious thought. So Hooked is really about how do these products get us to check these, check in with them, use these products with little or no conscious thought.
So you started looking at these companies and found that patterns were emerging, even though a lot of them would seem to do very different things.
Right, exactly. So in my study of what was it that made these products so habit-forming, how did they change consumer behavior in such a relatively short period of time, I found this pattern that I call the hook model. The hook model has these 4 basic steps of a trigger, an action, a reward, and an investment. And it's through successive cycles through these 4 steps, by getting users to go through these phases, this is how consumer preferences are shaped, how tastes are formed, and how these habits take hold.
So the hook model starts with a trigger, and these can be either external or internal. How do they function depending on which kind you're talking about?
Right. So the internal trigger is kind of the promised land. What companies want to do to form a habit is to create an association with these internal triggers. These internal triggers are things like emotions, routines, situations, places, things that automatically trigger us because of a memory or an association that has been formed in the user's mind. So, for example, we're feeling lonely, we check Facebook. We're bored, we hop onto YouTube. If we're uncertain about pretty much anything before we scan our brains, what do? Well, we Google it, because there's been formed an association in our mind that whenever we feel this internal trigger, what I call this emotional itch, we instantly respond by scratching that itch with one of these products. Now, the external trigger is something in our environment that tells us what to do next. And we're very familiar with this, right? Advertising and call to action buttons like click here or buy now or tweet this. All of these things are external triggers. They tell the user what to do next, whereas the internal trigger, the information for what to do next, is a memory in the user's mind. So that's kind of the ultimate goal of these habit-forming products, is to become the go-to solution every time we experience these negative emotions in our lives.
And I guess once you can get there, that's good, because those external triggers, they can work, but they can also, too many of them, start to irritate people, right?
Exactly. Not only are they irritating, they're very expensive, right? So companies that I mentioned before, like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat, all of these companies would go out of business if they depended upon advertising or these external triggers to bring users back. So this book is really about how these companies whose business model depend on habits, they depend on people coming back time and time again on their own. And if it wasn't for those habits, these companies would collapse.
So after the trigger, we have the action, which is the thing we as users do in anticipation of some kind of reward. And it turns out the easier a company makes it to perform that action, the more likely we are, no big surprise here, to do it.
Exactly. So some of this comes out of the work of B.J. Fogg, who's a researcher here at Stanford. And Fogg tells us that for any human behavior, we need 3 things. We need sufficient motivation, ability, and a trigger. So motivation is the energy for action. It's how much we want to do something. And we talked about triggers already just a second ago. Now, at the ability part of B equals MAT, the A part of B equals MAT, this has to do with how difficult or easy something is to do. And it turns out that by shaping the user's environment or shaping the ability to do a particular behavior, this has a profound impact on how likely the user is to do something. So how much time something takes, how much money something costs, how much physical effort, even how many brain cycles, meaning how difficult something is to understand, all have a profound impact on how likely we are to do it. So the second phase of the hook in my hook model is that these companies get users to do this very, very simple action in anticipation of a reward. So for example, scrolling on Pinterest or pushing the play button on YouTube. These are very simple actions that are done with little or no conscious thought to get us to the reward, to get us to the point where our itch is scratched in the reward phase.
And this is a little more complicated than just a simple feedback loop where the action always leads to a reward. Can you explain why variable rewards are so good at keeping us coming back?
Right. So the third step of the hook is the variable reward phase. And the variable rewards come from the classic work of B.F. Skinner. You might remember Skinner from our Psych 101 class back in college, the father of operant conditioning. He did these really interesting experiments where he would train pigeons to peck at this disc to receive a reward, in this case, a little food pellet. Well, at first, Skinner observed that every time the pigeon would peck at the disc, they would receive a food pellet. He could train them to do this behavior. So basically, the pigeons would peck at the disc whenever they were hungry. But then Skinner did something a little bit different. He introduced an intermittent reward. So sometimes the pigeons would peck at the disc, nothing would happen. The next time the pigeon would peck at the disc, they would receive a reward. And what Skinner observed was that the rate of response, the number of times that this behavior was observed, occurred more frequently when the reward was given on a variable schedule of reinforcement. And so in all sorts of products that we find most habit-forming, the ones that capture our attention and won't let go, you will find this element of mystery, this bit of the unknown. Because it turns out that this process, this variable reward, spikes activity in a particular part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, which increases our focus, increases our engagement, and keeps us coming back.
So this is a little bit like why we get, you know, if we sit down at a slot machine, we want to keep going because maybe the next time we're going to win something.
Exactly. And we find a very similar mechanism to why we keep pulling on those levers on a slot machine. We find almost exactly the same psychology going on online. If you think about when you scroll in your feed, be it on Twitter or Facebook, when you're looking through your feed or on Pinterest, when you're scrolling and scrolling, you're searching for this next reward, this variable outcome. Some tweets are interesting, some are not. Some things on Facebook are very exciting, some are mundane. Pinterest is full of this mix of, you know, this boring stuff, and then there's all these images that are really interesting and exciting. And that search and search and search for these rewards is exactly the same mechanism, the same psychology that keeps us pulling on a slot machine, for example.
So, Nir, this part sounds counterintuitive, but you say the more time or effort or money or data we have sunk into something, the more likely we are to stick with it. Can you talk about how that investment tends to make the experience better for us?
Right. So the fourth phase of the hook model is this investment phase. And it turns out that these companies do a marvelous job of asking users to put in something into the product to increase the likelihood of the next pass. And this investment phase turns out to be critical, and it's something that's very different from just a traditional feedback loop. Feedback loops don't have investment, but when it comes to a product or service that we form a habit around, investment is critical. So it's some kind of bit of work that the user does to increase the likelihood of the next pass. So it could be something like data, giving a company data about your preferences so that every time you use Twitter, when you follow somebody, when you reply, you're giving the company more information about your preferences. Pinterest is a great example of that. When you pin something on Pinterest or you star something or you comment, you're giving the company more data to make the product better with use. Followers, the more followers I accrue, I'm storing value in the product, and the product gets better as a way for me to reach my audience the more followers I have. So if Twitter tomorrow were to send out an email that says, hey, look, we're going to make Twitter now a paid service. You can't use it for free anymore. Well, who's more likely to pay? Is it going to be someone with 10 followers or 10,000 followers? Of course, it's going to be the person with 10,000 followers because they've stored value in the company, in the service, by accruing all these followers. It can also take the form of reputation. On eBay or TaskRabbit or Airbnb, the higher my reputation score, I can literally take that stored value to the bank because I can earn more money for my goods and services that I'm selling on these platforms based on my reputation score. And how likely am I to leave one of these services after I've accrued all this stored value in the form of reputation? It's kind of hard to do. It's a little hard to leave. It becomes more sticky. And so there's other forms of investment that keep us coming back.
So that also speaks to first mover advantage, right? You think about a social media platform like Google Plus, which for all I know is just as good as Facebook or better, but people who are there and have collections of friends there are unlikely to make the jump over unless they're guaranteed that everything they've done and collected on Facebook will go with them.
Right. So this is why habits are a huge competitive advantage. And the cold, hard truth is, especially here where I live in Silicon Valley, that the best products don't win.
Hmm.
Right? The fact is that you don't necessarily have to make a better product. That many times it's just the product that has formed the stickier habit that becomes the market dominator. That it's very hard to dislodge a product that has formed a user habit. When once we have formed this mental association that the solution to our pain point, that internal trigger, that itch, is solved with one product, well, we turn to it time and time again, and we don't even ask if there's something better out there. Speaking of Google, not Google Plus, but let's take a look at what makes the vast majority of Google's money, Google's search engine. Well, it turns out if you compare Google to Bing search engine, that if you strip away the branding and you just show the search results, that independent studies have found that people have almost a 50-50 preference split.
Hmm.
And yet Google dominates the market, right? They have 87% market share of people searching with their search engine, even though there's another product that turns out to be pretty good, almost exactly as good. And in fact, Bing has struggled very hard over the past several years to offer all kinds of incentives. Did you know that Bing will actually pay you? And this isn't, I have no affiliation with them, but it's just an example of how a company can actually, you know, be better, try everything they can to bring users over. But if there's a very strong habit to use one product over another, it's incredibly difficult to get users to switch.
And of course, nobody says, I need to Bing that and figure out, you know,
right,
what we're talking about here. So is there an inherent conflict between making the action part of a hook easy to do and encouraging that investment at the same time?
So it's a timing question. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that the action is the simplest behavior in anticipation of a reward. It comes before the reward. But after the user got what they want, after their itch is scratched a little bit, that's where these companies ask for investment. So let's go through the Facebook hook, if you will. So the Facebook hook, the internal trigger is this feeling of boredom, is this few minutes you might have in between tasks. Well, you hop onto Facebook to scratch that itch of boredom. The action is to simply log in. And as soon as you start scrolling through your newsfeed and looking and reading about what people have posted, well, now you see this cornucopia of all these interesting things, right? And there's variability. What did people post? What do the comments say? How many likes did something get? High degree of social variability, of course, the variable reward phase of the hook. And then the investment comes every time you like something, you post something, you comment on something, you add a friend. Well, you're investing in the platform. You're making the platform better and better by giving them your data. So that if you logged into my Facebook account, it actually wouldn't be all that interesting for you because it's been tailored to my data.
Nir Eyal is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Nir Eyal, a veteran of the video gaming and advertising industries who's taught courses on applied consumer psychology at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. His new book is called Hooked: How to Build Habit-Forming Products. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Nir, we all have tons of habits, right? Some are good, some are bad, some could probably be called neutral. Is it ethical for companies to design things that, for lack of a better word, manipulate us into forming more habits?
Yeah, I think this is a terrific question, and it's a big part of why I wrote the book. I mean, the first reason I wrote the book was to help entrepreneurs. I've started two companies, and I know how difficult it can be to build a business that people want to return back to. So the first reason I wrote the book was to help entrepreneurs build for healthy habits. As you mentioned, you know, we have good habits, we have healthy habits. Unlike addictions, by the way, which is a different thing altogether, the book is not how to create addictive products. It's how to build habit-forming products, because addictions always hurt people. That's a different category. But when it comes to habits, you know, I believe that we're in the precipice of this age where we can use the deeper psychology of habit design to help people live happier, healthier, more connected lives. And a lot of the work that I do in my consulting practice, as well as the companies I invest in as an angel investor, I look for these companies that are using habits for good to help people live better. But the second reason I wrote this book was because I do believe that the world is becoming a potentially more addictive place. And that as consumers of this technology, even if you're not building a business, you're probably a consumer of this technology, and that I think we all need to understand how these products change our behavior so that we can prevent unwanted manipulation, so that we can put technology in its place.
So I'm not a huge video game player, but I have, you know, played around with some. And I'm always astonished at some of the most habit-forming games are really the dumbest. And they're not the ones with, like, spectacular production design or artistic value. Can you talk about why something like Angry Birds or Candy Crush becomes such a sensation?
Sure. So there's great hooks involved with these products. You know, if you think about the trigger action reward investment in these products, there's a lot there that keeps us coming back around this variable reward. So many games, you know, some of them, for example, Flappy Birds, what was it, 3 or 4 months ago was a big deal, maybe a little longer now. But this is a very simple game that somebody built in the, you know, in the course of a few days, it seemed like. It was very simple, pixelated, nothing special. And yet it had millions and millions of downloads. And it was all about getting this bird to pass through, to fly through these sections of pipe. It was incredibly simple. The thing is, though, that when it comes to these games, they're interesting for a while. But then, of course, we move to the next thing, right? There's a reason that we're not all playing Super Mario Brothers anymore, or Pac-Man, or, you know, even Farmville. Remember a few years ago, Farmville was such a big deal. Zynga was valued at something like $10 billion. Now it's, you know, 80% less than that today. But these companies kind of produce these games that come and go time and time again. So the question is, of course, why? How do these games become so habit-forming? How do they engage us, and how do people get so into these games for a while, and then somehow they pass like any other fad? Well, the reason is that what was great about these games, which is the variability that we talked about earlier, the variable reward phase, this intermittent reward, becomes over time predictable, right? So if you think about Farmville, for example, the company that made Farmville is called Zynga. And then after Farmville was such a huge success, it was the fastest growing video game in history. After that, I think they released Cityville and then Chefville and then Farmville. And it was basically the same game again and again and again. And users figured out, hey, this is kind of boring, right? They figured it out. They got to an end. It wasn't variable anymore. It became predictable. So users moved on to the next exciting thing.
So you have to, if you're designing these things, you have to anticipate that they have a shelf life.
Right. And you know, these variable rewards are endemic to a lot of different industries. The news business, the movie industry, the publishing business. I mean, all of these things employ what I call finite variability. They make products that the more we engage with them, the more predictable they become. So when we see a movie, we get to the end. That's it. you know, very few movies do we ever watch more than once. I mean, there's some cult classics that we watch again and again for other reasons. We want to analyze the filmmaking, or we want to connect with our other Trekkies or something, that, you know, then we would watch them again and again. But really, if you think about the number of books we watch, we read more than once, or the number of movies we watch more than once, or, you know, who reads yesterday's newspaper, the reason those things are no longer engaging is because they're not variable anymore. There's no mystery involved. And so we move on. And so those business models have to constantly create new.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now. We have Marlon on the line in Dallas. Hey, Marlon.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
Good. First-time listener, a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
I just wanted to ask him, there's actually some new games that have come out. One of them is called Destiny. He may or may not be familiar with it. But I have noticed it seems that the gaming community, I guess from a larger perspective for consoles and whatnot, are kind of employing this, some of the things he's talking about, to the wider video game companies as a whole. And it's focusing less on gaming and more on kind of getting people hooked, as he was talking about. And I really wanted to get his ideas on that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, Destiny is a great example. It's interesting. I had a reader of my book write an entire blog post. I think it was something like 1,500 words that he wrote about, here's the hook in the Destiny game. So that's a terrific example. And I used to be in the gaming industry, and a lot of the techniques that I describe in the book are lessons that I learned being in that industry. My idea behind the book was that, you know, I don't think that these techniques, that these psychological practices that get people to come back time and again should be exclusive to that industry. That I think that we can use the same things that make video games engaging, that make for great film, that make for great literature, that keep us coming back. You know, this is something that we can use in all sorts of industries, that entrepreneurs and startup founders can use to make all sorts of products better.
So hooked users are typically pretty good evangelists for the products that they do use?
Well, there is something to the fact that if your product is something that is used habitually, there's a much higher chance that it will be spread, right? So the products that have that go viral, so to speak, it's kind of an overused buzzword these days about things going viral. But it turns out that virality alone, that people telling other people about your product, is actually not enough. Because if you think about it, if somebody tells about your company once a year, well, that's never going to get you the hockey stick growth that we here in Silicon Valley want to see. What you really need is people to use these products frequently enough so that they have the opportunity to tell others about it, you know, hopefully every day. So if you think about the products that are most habit-forming, these are things that are not only used daily, but intra-daily, right? We check Facebook, some people, hundreds of times a day. We open up our smartphones hundreds of times a day. We check Twitter throughout the day. And so these things not only have a potential to be very habit-forming, they also have this potential to grow very big, very quickly.
I'm curious about the disconnect between products that people use habitually. And I'm thinking here of things like cable or satellite TV, right? People might constantly go to the service every single day, but like nobody loves their cable company. What's going on there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that the habit isn't necessarily buying cable. It's not your interaction with the cable company. It's using your television. And that's kind of the habit. If, you know, sometimes people ask this question of, you know, is this good? And are the transitioning to playing more games and more Facebook and more Instagram and Twitter, is that good? And oftentimes I say, well, look, we don't live in a vacuum. That the habit today already exists. And that habit is with television. And the average American spends 5 hours a night watching television. And so this existing habit of, think about the internal trigger. What's the itch? When we come home from work, we've had a long day, we're tired, we want to veg out. And so the action is to flick on the television set. Of course, the variable rewards are full, right? There's tons of variable rewards when it comes to television. It's the programming in itself. And then, of course, the investment comes. If you've ever watched a series that brings you back, there's always the cliffhanger, right? You become emotionally invested in what's going to happen next on Game of Thrones. How is the conflict going to resolve? And by you spending the time and the emotional investment of wanting to know what's next, you're going to tune into the next episode.
Some smart companies are willing to sacrifice a little to maintain the trust of their customers and keep them coming back. Will you tell us how Amazon does this?
How they sacrifice the...
They're willing to sell products or make available products that they're not even selling themselves so that consumers can sort of make sure that they go to Amazon first to buy things.
Right. So in Amazon's case, I don't know if they're I don't think they're I think they're building this habit because they want to be the go-to source for anytime you need anything, come to Amazon. They're trying to create this mental association that when I feel this pang of discomfort of I need something and I don't know where to find it, Amazon is the first thing that comes to mind. And that habit is so important to them that they're actually willing to put competitors' ads on their site, which sounds crazy, right? Who would do that? Why would you put a competing product's ad on your site? Well, Amazon does that because they want to be the go-to source. They want to form this habit that whenever you need something, whenever you need to buy, it's with them.
It also puts them in an easy position to be aware of who's offering a lower price, and I would imagine that that would trigger, a competitive price on their own site.
Doesn't hurt either, right?
What's the difference between products that you compare to vitamins and those that function more like painkillers?
Right. So there's this dichotomy these days that many startup founders, when they come here to Silicon Valley and they will pitch an investor, they'll go talk to a VC and they try to raise money. And many times investors will dismiss these companies because they'll call them vitamins. And even if you're not raising money in Silicon Valley, you're not trying to raise venture capital, many of us have heard this dichotomy in one way or the other in our jobs, right? You have this great idea for this innovation that you wanna bring about, and you talk to your boss or some internal stakeholder, and they dismiss it because it's not something that's that important. It's just a vitamin. It's not something that you have to have. It's a nice to have. Right. Whereas a painkillers are the kind of products that businesses typically like to invest in. This is the kind of product that venture capitalists drool over, something that stops the user's pain. And the traditional thinking has been make painkillers, don't make vitamins. And many times when these products come to market, when people first see Snapchat or Instagram or Facebook or Twitter, they dismiss these products. They call them vitamins. But what they fail to realize is that many times vitamins become painkillers. That what's endemic to habit-forming technologies is that they start off as these fun behaviors, these vitamins, these nice-to-haves. And by running users through these hooks, by passing through these four steps of the hook model that we described earlier, they become critical components to people's lives. So, a decade ago, nobody woke up in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. and said, I need to update my status, right? They didn't, before Facebook existed, they didn't know they had that problem. But now that they've been habituated to using Facebook, if Facebook shut down tomorrow and Zuckerberg said, you know what, I've made enough money, I'm done, they would have conniption fits. This would be a big problem for them because they've formed a habit around this product.
I'm old enough to remember a time before everybody over the age of 10 or 12 had a cell phone. And I remember when they first existed and some people had them and not a lot of people felt like they were necessary. The functionality was similar. I mean, they weren't online, but you could make calls with them. You could take them anywhere. They existed. And yet most people thought they're kind of ostentatious. I don't want one of those. Mm-hmm. What should companies do to know that, in fact, they are onto something that is going to break big in 3 years or whatever it might be?
Right. So I would recommend the first thing to do is before you even start designing a product, if your business model necessitates a habit, and by the way, not every business model needs a habit. There's lots of businesses that can bring users back with other things. You can use advertising. You can use search engine optimization. Heck, you can have a physical storefront to bring people back to your place of business. But if your business requires a habit, if your product necessitates unprompted user engagement, just like the companies we described earlier, then the first step is to figure out what is your hook, is to figure out what is your four steps. How can you, and this is something you can do with a pen and paper, how do you pass users through a trigger, action, reward, investment? And then the next step is to go experiment. We still have to follow these what's called lean methodologies of putting something into the world, testing it, measuring the effect, and then changing the product, building differently based on user feedback. What I hope to do is to give innovators, to give people who are designing products, kind of this toolkit, this framework, so that they can fail less. Right? We're still going to iterate. We're still going to fail. That's part of the startup development process. But the idea is here's this kind of toolkit that you can use from consumer psychology to help you build better from the get-go.
Can adding functionality to a product affect its hook factor?
Sure. In fact, sometimes adding functionality can backfire. I see a lot of companies that try and make products more complex because the engineers can, as opposed to thinking should they. They just think could they. And oftentimes by increasing what we call cognitive load, by adding too much functionality, too many buttons, by making it too complex, it actually reduces the action. It makes it more difficult for the user to get to the reward and can often backfire. So many times it's actually reducing functionality. To form a habit, we want to make the behavior as simple as possible to do. And so, I'll give you a quick story. My mother didn't touch email for forever, right? We were all kind of, we love technology, and my brothers, I have two older brothers, we were always tinkering with all kind of gadgets in our childhood. But my mother just refused to touch anything having to do with computers until she got an iPad. And the fact that the iPad made getting online so simple, right? She didn't have to boot anything up. There wasn't any big, you know, process to get to what she wanted to do. It was just so made so much easier that now she's hooked, right? Now she's constantly emailing and using her apps because this iPad simplified the process of clearing the clutter, making it easier for her to do the few actions she wanted to do. And of course, now we see her using it much more frequently.
Of course, devices like the iPad and the iPhone, they clear the clutter, and yet they function as these incredibly powerful tools. They take pictures, they function as a calculator, they're a GPS service. There's a lot packed in there.
Right, but of course, you have to, you know, as you learn one behavior, then you learn more and more and more. And that's kind of how these habits work, by the way. You know, they start off with one core hook. So for a while, it was just checking email. And then when she got comfortable with that, then she would move on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And that's, you know, it's progressive disclosure. They kind of teach you one habit that then is built upon to form the next habit, the next habit, the next habit. So on Facebook, it's really about just consuming the content at first. And then the next thing might be to like something or comment on something. And then eventually you're going to start posting. And then you reveal more and more of these power features. And the trick, of course, as a product designer is to figure out how do you disclose certain features first, second, third. What's that prioritization? Which habits do you build on top of which?
Nir Eyal is my guest. He's a veteran of the video gaming and advertising industries and author of a new book called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Nir Eyal, who has taught courses on applied consumer psychology at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and is author of the new book Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So before the break, you were saying that, companies have to decide how to prioritize the rollout of features and which comes first and which follows. How do they begin to evaluate how this will work best?
Well, they start thinking about the product holistically in terms of what habit they're trying to create, what's fundamental to their business model. So with a company like Facebook or Twitter, it's really about you checking in. It's about you opening the app and engaging with the product. And then they figure out, you know, for this product or service they're trying to lay out, what order do they come in. And it typically starts with the simplest behavior. So it might be something as easy as scrolling at first. And then as they pass through the successive cycles through the hook, the behaviors get increasingly complex. You invest more and more and more into the service.
How can offline companies build consumer habits?
Right. So there's a lot to be learned from consumer psychology piecemeal. So the book that I wrote, Hooked, How to Build High-Performing Products, has a lot in it that I think any business owner could benefit from. Understanding how what drives consumer behavior, from the heuristics that make us behave the way we behave, even though we're not able to necessarily articulate those ways that we behave, gives a lot of lessons to any business. But if your product requires a habit, you have a higher bar. So while you can pick and choose from the chapters of the book, the different lessons from consumer psychology to build a better business, if you're building a habit, if your business model necessitates a habit, then you have this very high bar because you actually have to have all four. You have to have the trigger, action, reward, and investment. Without that, it's going to be almost impossible to build that habit.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Mike in Louisville. Hi, Mike.
Yes. I'm retired, and I just go online to these war games, and at first they say play for free, but now I'm investing a lot of time and a lot of money, and I just got to somehow disengage.
Any thoughts on that? Can we reverse engineer the Hooked model, Nir, if we don't want to be spending so much time with these products?
Absolutely. This is a big reason why I wrote this book. As I mentioned before, you know, I think the world is becoming a potentially more addictive place. And I think until now, we've seen these things as just these frivolities, entertainment. But look, these things are by design made to bring you back, made to hook you, and in some industries, addict you. And so I think it's absolutely critical that we all understand why is the world becoming a more addictive place and what can we do about it. It's only by understanding this model, by understanding these hooks in these products, can we actually begin to put technology in its place and make sure that we control it as opposed to it controlling us. And there's a bunch of techniques that we can use that, in fact, you know, I'm an advocate as much for building hooks for healthy habits as I am for breaking hooks for the habits that we don't want in our lives. So there's several things that I do in my own life to put technology in its place. And frankly, you know, even for the author of this book, it's a struggle. I struggle all the time with trying to figure out where does technology belong and where does it not belong. And so whether it's with my child, whether it's in terms of my relationship with my wife, you know, how do I make sure that technology doesn't intrude on my life so that it serves me as opposed to, you know, being a servant to it? And there's a few things that we can do. So one, the first thing to do is to remove the triggers. Remember, the first phase of the hook model is the trigger phase. And so one thing that I recommend to a lot of people is that we don't keep technology in the bedroom. I don't think technology should necessarily be in the bedroom. So this habit of charging your cell phone on your bedstand, if you're finding that the first thing you do in the morning is reach for your phone on your nightstand, or the last thing you do at night is to check your phone, well, a great thing to do, and what I've done in my own house, is to charge those devices outside the bedroom, is to put to charge them in the living room or somewhere else so that the trigger isn't so enticing, so that it's not right there all the time. The next thing to do is to make the action harder. The next phase of the hook is the action phase. So figure out ways to make the behavior that you don't want to do more difficult. So here's what I did in terms of my technology habits. I found that I wasn't getting to bed on time, and I wasn't spending enough quality time with my wife after we'd put our daughter to bed. You know, we were checking email and Facebook and pecking at our devices as opposed to having a conversation together. So I went to the hardware store, and I bought a $10 timer that I could plug into my outlet, and into that outlet timer, I plugged in my router so that every night at 10 p.m., my internet shuts off. So what did I do just then? I could still go on the internet, but now I'd have to unplug that timer, replug in my router. It's a lot of work. It's more difficult. So it gives me those few seconds of mental space that I can ask myself, is this really necessary? So instead of being mindless and just checking email or going onto Facebook or playing a game, for example, there's this few seconds of mindfulness. Do I really need to be doing this behavior, or, you know, is there some way I could better spend my time right now? So make the action harder. And then the last step is to make sure you don't invest in these services, right? So as the gentleman who just called said, that he's spending more and more time and more money into these services. And so, look, I think a big reason why I want the world to know about these four steps of the hook model and how products are designed this way is because once we recognize what's going on, we can do something about it. You know, one of the most successful, if not the most successful, anti-smoking campaign in history was the Truth Campaign, which was all about exposing mostly teenagers to the fact that the tobacco industry intentionally designs cigarettes to be addictive. Well, I think that's something that we all need to do also with the technology industry, that these products are designed to bring us back. And sometimes these things are great. I'm a huge advocate of technology when it's in the right place. So we have to make sure that we put it in the right place and not start down the path of using potentially habit-forming or addictive products when we know that they're designed to potentially, become things that don't serve us necessarily.
One thing I hadn't thought a lot about until I read your book was the success of platforms like Pinterest. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting because lots of people who maybe wouldn't feel like technologically inclined enough to make their own website or write their own blog about baking or whatever their hobby might be can start up a Pinterest page without too much work.
Right. And that's something that we've seen in the evolution of technology in general. And of course, when it comes to the web in particular, that the easier it becomes to create content, the more people do it. And we can actually graph this, that the easier it becomes. So if you think about Web 1.0 was when big companies were the only ones that created content. The New York Times and CNET and these companies would hire a few people to make content for the masses because it was very difficult to do back then, right? Dial-up modems and you'd need to buy your own servers. And it was a big deal to get content on the web. Well, now, you know, if you think about Web 2.0 and social media, it's become so easy to do. The action has become so much easier to do back to that action phase of the hook that, of course, a higher proportion of people now do it. So the easier behavior is to do, the more likely people are to do that behavior.
Have we gotten too conditioned to give over our data in exchange for, in many cases, a pretty negligible reward?
Well, I think, you know, by and large, I'm an advocate for these technologies. I think these technologies are great. Now, of course, as I mentioned earlier, they have to be put in their place. And so I think until now, we've kind of bought into these technologies wholesale. We've just used them everywhere all the time, and we haven't developed the rules, the manners, the mores to put technology in its place. And so I think data is one of those things that we've become so eager to use these products that many times we don't consider exactly what we're giving over. And so I think it's fantastic that we're having this conversation around, you know, what kind of data do we share? How do we share it? Where do we share it? But I'm pretty optimistic. I think the fact that people have these reservations about sharing certain types of data means that the market will create solutions for them. For example, Snapchat is an incredibly popular app among college students and teenagers. I think they are raising at something like a $3 billion valuation recently, so it's a very, very valuable company. And their whole company premise is around the fact that people didn't want these images that they're sharing with others to be available on the web. So when I send someone a picture over Snapchat, it explodes. It's gone. It disappears. And so that piece of data, that my image, for example, is not going to follow me around in 10 years and haunt me if I did something silly at a party and took a picture of myself. So, you know, the market responded by creating these new solutions that made made it easier to send pictures because now I don't have to worry about is this data I'm giving over, these images I'm giving over, going to come back and haunt me. The other side, by the way, of this data equation, there's a lot of questions around the intrusion on privacy when we give over all this data. But if you think about it, there's also an upside to giving all this data in that for the first time, companies building potentially addictive products can do something with that data if they so choose. So, for example, you know, addiction and addictive products is nothing new. It's been around for a very, very long time. But in the past, when you think about people making addictive products, if you were an alcohol brewer or distiller, you could throw up your hands and say, well, we don't know who's getting drunk on our beer. We don't know who the alcoholics are. Well, how can we do anything about it? Well, the good news is that these companies, because they have personally identifiable information today, the gaming companies, the social media companies, if someone is using one of these products to an unhealthy degree, they could do something about it. That's the upside of having this personal identifiable data. They could restrict use. They could give that person information on how to use that product less. They could raise a flag to say, hey, look, you know, you're using this product in ways that are consistent with someone with an addictive problem.
Well, they could, but we don't have any evidence that they are doing that, do we?
Well, my call to action is that, and I've written about this in TechCrunch and other publications, is that I think companies making potentially addictive products should have a use and abuse policy that says there's some number that if you use this product more than this amount of hours per week, whatever, that's too much. Some companies are already doing that. Stack Overflow is a question and answer site that after 20 hours of use in a week, you can't accrue any more points. Because one of the founders, Jeff Atwood, believed that Stack Overflow needed to enhance your life and not become your life. So they already have this policy in place. And for many companies, I think it's something they could easily do, like for Facebook and Twitter. Those companies could easily do that. Now, it's a very, very, very small percentage of users who go too far, who get addicted. But that doesn't mean we should ignore these people. If they're overusing these products, we should do something about it. But the interesting thing is, what happens when a company depends on the addicts? Then it's a really interesting question. So when you think about the gambling industry, when you think about free-to-play games, what happens if an industry believes that doing something about the addicts is an existential threat? That becomes a really interesting ethical dilemma, and one that I hope to see kind of play out over the next several years here, that perhaps these companies should do more. Now, whether they will or they'll be forced to do something about them is another question.
Do you think the tech industry eventually will evolve like ethical organizations in the same way that doctors and lawyers and even journalists have organizations designed to sort of hold everybody to a high ethical standard?
I certainly hope so. I mean, that's the future that that's the world I want to live in, where companies make products that they believe improve people's lives. And again, by and large, all the products we've talked about, I think, enhance people's lives for the vast majority of people. Maybe some people go too far sometimes. Maybe they're bad habits. But for the vast majority of people, they can moderate, just like we do with other addictive products like alcohol or gambling. You know, most people don't have an addiction problem. Maybe they have a bad habit from time to time, but they can dial it back. But there are some people who meet the psychographic profile of addiction who want to stop and can't. And I think for those people, we owe it to them to do something for them. Of course, there's more than one party involved here. Not only is there the maker, there's also the user. And there's of course, a good sense of personal responsibility that all of us need to be more aware of how these products are designed to bring us back, and that we should moderate our use so that we make sure that these products are serving us as opposed to us serving them.
Since you have a pretty far view on the horizon, are there any particularly hooky products out there that we should keep an eye out for that may be part of our lives the next couple of years?
Well, I think the smartwatch is going to be a very big deal.
Really?
I think the fact that, you know, anytime there's this big interface switch. And we saw this, of course, when desktop went to laptop and then to mobile and now to wearable. Every time there's this big interface shift, the habit deck gets reshuffled, so to speak. And so I think there are going to be several billion-dollar companies made on this platform of the smartwatch, just as there were all these amazing success stories made on the mobile interface now that so many people have smartphones. Over the next few years, I think the smartwatch is going to be a very big deal, which necessitates more habits. If you think about it, there's less real estate, right? The amount of screen space on the smartwatch is much smaller than even the mobile interface, which means that there's less triggering opportunities to flash ads or calls to action on the screen, which means that the companies that succeed, it's going to be even more important to form these habits.
Nir Eyal is a veteran of the video gaming and advertising industries and has taught courses on applied consumer psychology. His new book, written with Ryan Hoover, is called Hooked: How to Build Habit-Forming Products. Nir, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Eric Bright. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.